Hey, what's up, guys? Welcome to another episode of the Tactics Con podcast. I'm Stuart Amadon, and with me today is Jordan Bush. What's up, Jordan? Good to see you, buddy.
Not too much, brother. Great to see you.
I'm glad we get to hang out doing this stuff. So you and I met a while back at the Tactics Conference the first time. Or did we meet on Twitter first? Was that
We met on Twitter. Yeah, I think we chatted on Twitter and stuff.
Yeah, we did. See, that's what I love about Twitter. It's where I meet all my cool reform bros. It goes great. So we met a while back. And then you and I got to visit a little bit more, and you came and hung out and talked a little bit at the Tactics Conference about Bitcoin. Yep. Now, I've got a little bit of experience with cryptocurrency in my past, but I use the dreaded altcoins. Don't judge me. You know, I'm here to be converted. I'm here to get you to convince me to dump my money into Bitcoin. That's what I'm really here for. So, So that's really my desire here today is I look at the economic landscape in the future, and I think it's time for Christians to start getting creative in what they're doing with their money and trying to hold on and generate wealth for future generations to be able to leave an inheritance to our grandchildren. And I think that crypto is a great way to do that. And I'm intrigued by your specificity in the lane of Bitcoin. So why don't we start off by you first telling me a little bit, you know, about yourself and how you got to this point.
Yeah. So I did not set out to be the Christian Bitcoin guy. I did not. That was not my goal. But basically, I was a church planting missionary. My wife and I were missionaries and our kids. We were missionaries in Uruguay in South America. We moved there to plant a church in a very secular city. About 40% of the country of Uruguay as a whole just openly says that they're atheist or agnostic. And then about 50% of people would claim to be Roman Catholic, but only about 5% actually practice. So you have a lot of people who are functionally, like religion functionally plays no meaningful role in their day-to-day lives.
Okay.
And so we went there thinking, hey, we're going to plant a church in this, you know, middle to upper class part of the city. Yeah. There's very few churches that are there. We found out why as time went on, but we thought, hey, let's go do that. My wife and I were both philosophy majors in college and you know, talking with people who didn't share, you know, our worldview, and was something that we just really enjoyed doing and wanted to see the gospel, you know, Christ glorified and loved and worshiped in places where he's not currently being worshiped. So we moved there. And the thing that hit us right off the bat was we'd been sitting there for 3 years. We raised support. And so we were telling people all this narrative about, you know, how secular Uruguay is. And that was true. But when we got there, the thing that we found was that the people who we initially started to minister to, in addition to the Uruguayans who were there, were Venezuelan immigrants. There was a mass immigration, at one point over 60,000 Venezuelan immigrants. It's probably increased even now, even more now. But basically over the course of a few years, 60,000 Venezuelan immigrants poured into Uruguay because they were trying to escape Venezuela and the government, who had hyperinflated their currency until it became worthless.
Yeah.
And people were literally throwing, I mean, just thousands of bills into the trash can because it was worthless. And so as we were trying to help our, you know, people who became our brothers and sisters, you know, pick up the pieces of their lives, I just was, again, just curious, just trying to understand why it had happened. And so again, I got the initial broad answer: the government hyperinflated the currency. But in terms of like the mechanics of that, like how does that work? This is what happens in democracies is that, you know, you have a guy who's in power, and you have a guy who's coming along after him, who's, you know, trying to get people to vote for him, or the existing, you know, the existing president or whatever is trying to stay in power. Mm-hmm. And so how do you get people to vote for you? You promise them free stuff. It's pretty simple. You know, we're pretty simple creatures. If people want to give us, there's a documentary about how NFL players end up, you know, broke. And there was a famous phrase from that documentary that said, "Free, I'll take three." And so they just talked about how these athletes, they get free stuff all the time. They're like, hey, if you're going to give me something for free, give me two or three of them. And so that's how politics works largely, is, you know, whoever promises the most free stuff,
gets
ends
the
up
votes.
Winning.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. And so just that's what happened over time. The president of Venezuela promised more and more free stuff. And then it got to the point where just the money became worthless. And so again, we're trying to understand that. And again, just to give some context, because people might not understand Venezuela. Like, Venezuela is not just this dirt poor, you know, resource poor place where, you know, it's full of poverty for generations. It's actually not like that at all. Even after this hyperinflation crisis had been happening for a few years, gas was still 2 cents a gallon in Venezuela. And so it's this very prosperous country that ended up just, you know, going down this road. And so, so basically got to the point where I just was trying to understand this, not in any, you know, systematic form, was just, you know, learning and taking this stuff in. And over time just found that this had happened in every single currency in Latin America almost had failed 3 to 4 times since 1971 when the world went off the gold standard. Yeah. And so again, I just was like, okay, well, this isn't new. But this is obviously still really bad because, you know, right. we had Venezuelan brothers and sisters who had to leave their wives and kids in Venezuela, move to Uruguay, try to get a job, save up some money to send home initially, but then eventually to bring them to Uruguay. Mm. And so we just saw, you know, like this issue separates families. It makes kids grow up without their dads. Mm. It produces, you know, infidelity in marriages. We saw, you know, saw and experienced that. And so again, just saw how this affected in the worst case scenarios in something like Venezuela. But then even additionally in the countries like Uruguay, where, you know, it wasn't that bad yet, it still is cyclical. And so it still affects the everyday people. And so,
yeah,
you know, there's very few churches. One example of this is there's very few churches that can afford to buy buildings because over time, as the currency fails, the prices of scarce assets continue to go up and up and up in value.
Right.
If you don't have a way to compensate for the loss of your purchasing power of your, you know, your money, the thing you're denominating life in, you're going to just stay perpetually behind unless something, you know, happens. And so, so we saw lots of just in terms of even just on the missions front, just reliance on the United States, reliance on missionaries and organizations, and praise God for those organizations that are helping fund ministry. But it's just this thing that's not sustainable, broadly speaking. Because the underlying denominator for life in these places is just getting more worthless with every day that goes by.
So that sends you in a direction of saying, all right, we need to find alternatives.
Yeah. So it just kind of put me in a position to say, like, what do you actually do about this? You know, like we're preaching the gospel, we're making disciples, we're doing all these things. So this is not somehow like I'm doing this instead of what we were doing. It just was while we're doing this, you know, we're sitting there looking at, I mean, we had 2 to 3 friends whose mothers had taken out payday loans in their names. And basically, and again, like they're at crazy interest rates. And like, so they're saddled with this debt going forward. And so you just, this kind of thing just happens. And you're like, what do you do about this?
Right.
Obviously making disciples and preaching the gospel. And, you know, like you train people to, you know, train people to love and to obey everything that Jesus commanded us. Like that's 100% true. And yet at the same time, like there's these systemic things within, you know, within a society that basically prevent for, you know, movement. And so as we were making disciples, I got invited to be a part of this book club with a number of other guys who were into Bitcoin. Almost all of them were basically, they were all Christians, but in different, we were like from all kinds of different backgrounds, different. We had people who grew up, walked completely away from the Lord and who were in the process of coming back or in the process of trying to figure out, you know, how do I think about this now? And so long story short, we ended up doing this book club. We read through 2 books. One was a little bit more like maybe college age reading level. It was called The Ethics of Money Production. Fantastic book. I think every pastor should read that book. And then the other book that we read was a more intro to this topic about the ethics of creating money. What does the Bible have to say about this? What biblical principles come to bear on that issue? Was a book called Honest Money by Gary North. And so that book, I would recommend for any of your listeners, no matter if you're like, I don't like to read, go read that book. It's written at probably an 8th grade reading level. It's fantastic. Very simple. And so again, just does a great job of, you know, laying out the biblical case for these things. And so we read the 2 books, you know, after a month and a half, I just thought, well, that was really cool. Really enjoyed it. This was during COVID in 2020. You know, it took like an hour a week and you know, just were reading through it. And so when it ended, I just thought, well, that was the weirdest thing that I've ever done. I had been into Bitcoin for about a year at that point. I'd been, you know, buying some of it and again, just more studying it. And so after that got done, I thought, well, that was weird. And 2 weeks later, one of the guys who I had done the book club with, a former pastor, just basically reached out and said, hey man, you know, we really appreciated your contribution to the book club. We're actually going to write our own book. Long story short, we're going to write our own book that basically takes a lot of these principles, but rather than applying them, you know, the action step, the call to action being let's go back to the gold standard, which is a perfectly acceptable. I don't think there's anything wrong with that in on any front. I think it's a good and it makes more sense than a lot of other things. Yeah. But they said, we think that, I mean, just I was on the page with this. We think that like Bitcoin represents, it has strengths at the exact points that gold has weaknesses. Bitcoin has strengths. And so we think that that's actually something that Christians should, you know, it has all the same benefits and it overcomes some of the weaknesses. And so we think that that's something we should do. If you're interested, you're more than welcome to participate in that. And so I just said to them, hey, I'm a pastor. I'm a pastor in this church. I don't have time to do that. And they just said, well, we're just going to work on it, you know, one day a week. And there'll be a couple, or it's like, yeah, one day a week for an hour or two. And then on the weekends, we'll do like a couple like sprints where for, you know, like a Saturday, you know, we do like 4 hours on a Saturday. And so as I just talked about it, thought about it, I was like, okay, like I can do that, you know, over a limited, you know, time frame. Yeah. So we ended up writing it. And the book came out in January 2021. And I love to tell people I got to experience every Protestant's dream, which was that we got to our book was called Thank God for Bitcoin. Halfway in cheek. It came out the same week as a book by the Pope, and we were outselling the Pope. So we were like, take that, Bishop of Rome. You know, where you at?
Well done.
Yeah. So we had zero ambitions to be like, oh, we're going to sell a bunch of books. But we just, there was, you know, Bitcoin's price was kind of going up a lot at that point. And so we just kind of just hit it the right time. And I think we've sold somewhere in the neighborhood of like 45,000 copies of Thank God for Bitcoin. And so like people are hungry to, again, just to know how to think about it from a Christian perspective. And so again, even though the book only talks about Bitcoin in the last two chapters, it's just more designed to be an intro to the topic. So,
yeah. So, okay. So give me the elevator pitch. Like I've dabbled in crypto. I feel safe in that space, for what it's worth. I am looking to continue to diversify our portfolio. And in the past, I've avoided Bitcoin specifically because I think mostly I'm hanging out with my altcoin bros. But also, I've gained a large volume of money faster through altcoins, through like, it's basically what we would call day trading. Okay.
Correct.
So hook me up with your Bitcoin elevator pitch. Why should I seriously consider Bitcoin and to what end?
Yeah, exactly. Great question. Okay. So there's a couple things before we get to the question, we have to get, like, there's a couple things that are undergirding it, right? Okay. So the first thing is that Christians don't just try to make money however they can, right? Like this is an extreme example. All right. I won't even use myself. Someone could prostitute their wife, right? They could say, I could make a lot more money if I prostituted my wife, right? Sure. Now again, any Christian would be like, I would never, you know, and praise the Lord. that would be horrible. Right. But the point is that there's ways that, like, all of us recognize we could make lots of money very quickly if we were willing to do certain things, if we were willing to sacrifice certain principles that we had. Mm-hmm. Now again, I'm not trying to draw an equivalence necessarily between, you know, prostitution and you know, buying things, these other currencies other than Bitcoin.
Sure.
At the same time, the question of, you know, like what are you going to invest in is a real thing. And like, who are you supporting? Because the reality of money is that, especially when you're doing an investment, you're subsidizing, right? So like when you give money, you're lending monetary energy to a company and, you know, an entity, you know, whatever it is. You're basically saying, I'm going to take some of the product of my hard work, labor, time, and I'm going to invest it in you. Okay. Mm. And here's another example. You know, like one of the, this is part of the process I went through is I, you know, again, this is the problem with being a philosophy major is you think way too much about all this stuff. But as you know, I got into Bitcoin from the first part because I was just trying to figure out what to invest in with our the money, that little bit of money that we had set aside for, you know, our retirement for being missionaries. So I'm sitting there, I didn't study economics or any of these things. So I'm like, okay, the one investing rule I know is that you buy low and you sell high. I'm like, this is investing 101.
That's all I got.
Exactly. That's all I got. I got nothing. But the issue that I faced in 2019 was I looked across the landscape of stocks, of real estate, of all these things, and everything is at all-time highs. Ever. Not just in the last few years. It's like ever in the history of the United States, all these things are at their all-time high prices. So I sat there and thought to myself, well, well, what do I do when everything's at all-time highs? Like, this is, you know, what am I supposed to do?
Right.
So I started to look through, okay, like, how do I think about investing? And so I started, went on this whole rabbit hole, tried to understand it. And so again, I had, you know, family again, who I love to death, who were like, hey, you know, you should just do some basic stocks, you know, invest in Coca-Cola, invest in these different things. And, you know, this is a solid way to get, you know, a decent return that over, you know, outpaces inflation, all these kind of stuff. Hmm. And so as I sat there, which again, that made all the sense in the world, again, just looking at it from the practical standpoint of, I need to make money. We need to be able to retire. These are the things that we just take for granted. These are the goals. I need to retire. So what am I going to do to be able to do that? I need to make X amount. And what I started to think about, because I'd listened to, you know, way too much good theological education and sermons and all kinds of stuff, was if I'm just pursuing the end goal of making money to be able to retire, and I'm not at the same time thinking about what is this money doing? Mm. That's just pragmatism. That's pragmatism. And in the process, I'm going to subsidize all kinds of things that maybe I don't want to be subsidizing.
Oh yeah. That's a great point.
The first one to acknowledge, though, that again, there's a limit to this. There's a limit to our ability to understand where, like, who is being affected by the money that we're spending.
Sure.
I'm not advocating morbid introspection where you can't even live your life because you're too worried about where all these things are going.
Right.
At the same time, as I thought about the prospect, specifically with Coca-Cola, okay, if I'm going to invest in Coca-Cola and make a significant return on it, what does this mean? It means that I'm making money by peddling sugar water to poor people.
Mm.
Like, functionally, all over the world, I'm peddling sugar water to poor people, which has all kinds of negative health, you know, externalities, all kinds of stuff. I just was like, man, I don't want to do that. And so, and then this, again, there's all kinds of other things. Even if you're not subsidizing, maybe you like the product itself, but there's all kinds of other things that you can invest in. So, like, Raytheon, right? if you want to make money, you can invest in these companies that, you know, profit off war. And I'm like, I don't feel great about that. am I gonna want to be sitting there lounging in my chair as a 70-year-old and know that the reason I'm able to relax is because I made money off wars? I'm like, I don't feel great about that. I don't want to do that. So when you start doing that, again, it limits. Again, it's not like there's no options. There's still plenty of good companies that are having real good productive, you know, products that are healthy and all kinds of other things that produce good incentives, but there's just not anywhere near as much as the broader market is there.
Right.
So when I started looking at Bitcoin through this lens, and I started to, like, try to understand what Bitcoin was and why it was created, the first thing that hit me is that Bitcoin was created in the aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis. And it was created because it was in response to the fact that the government had basically been able to bail out these profligate gambling companies. They'd been literally gambling with all kinds of people's money, playing with people's lives. And then the government stepped in and bailed them all out.
Hmm.
None of them went to jail. None of them, like, they had to pay some fine. Like, it was awful. And so the person or entity who created Bitcoin created it because, you know, they didn't like this reality that we have a currency that a government can just hyperinflate. The government can just create billions of new units of this currency out of thin air. And by doing that, devalue the purchasing power of the currency units being held by everybody else in the country, in the world, we know, whatever. And so Bitcoin is created for that reason. And so that, again, we could go a lot longer on that. But as I looked at this, I'm like, okay, so if I'm investing in Bitcoin, I am basically investing in a world that I want to see. This is a currency that can't be inflated. There's a fixed amount of them. This is a currency that, again, just over time, the more it's got exponential adoption ever since it was created, literally every year, the 15 years it's existed has been growing exponentially because the market of people who can use it is everyone who has internet today. So that's 4 billion people all over the world. And this is what hit me. It was, as if I invest in Bitcoin, I'm creating a stable currency that the poorest people all over the world, as long as they have internet access, which is more than you might think, I'm creating a more stable, like, alternative for them to invest in, no matter where they are. And so, again, there's a lot more we could say about that. But that's one of these things is, you know, where you're putting your money, you're subsidizing and you're creating more stability for that entity, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And in my case, if I do that with Bitcoin, this is the realization I have, is I can, if I lend my monetary energy and my time, what I've produced with my time, if I give that to Bitcoin, I not only help myself basically by not storing my wealth in something that can be devalued like the dollar, mm-hmm. but I am investing in something that is helping not only me, but is helping provide a more stable foundation monetarily for people all over the world. And so as I thought about this, like, I'm going to sit there as a 70-year-old man and say, all right, I invested in this. I helped to, make the world a more stable, a more sane place through this thing. I can do that. And so again, there's going to be lots of volatility. I'm willing to deal with volatility on the short term. I can, now some of that's a luxury, right? I'm a younger person. I can stomach some of the volatility today in the name of, the long-term, things there. So
right.
Now, again, what does that have to do with some of these other currencies? What this has to do is that Bitcoin is created in a way that is almost unique compared to all these other cryptocurrencies. And the way that you can see that most clearly is the fact that none of those other cryptocurrencies were created until after Bitcoin monetized, 2 years after its inception. So for 2 years, you had just people were using their computational power and investing real world resources into the energy needed to power them to what's called mine Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
For 2 years, the only motivation for doing that was completely speculative. People just thought, a lot of them thought it was just fun. It was this, really interesting computer science experiment. And so you had people who were just doing it. The only thing they got out of it was the pride of participating in the best way possible, of participating in this new internet weird project.
Yeah.
And just potentially, hey, this could go somewhere one day. But it wasn't until 2011. That somebody basically said, hey, I want to find somebody who will do basically the first Bitcoin transaction where I'll give them Bitcoin and they'll give me a real world good. And so this guy, I think his name was Laszlo, he found somebody who was willing to sell him two pizzas for 10,000 Bitcoin.
What?
Correct. So which today I think is something like over $200 million, something like that. So this guy, he found somebody who's willing to do it. So he sold it. And in that moment, okay, or in the weeks, the days and weeks to follow, what clicked with so many other people who were either in that space or who were getting into the space was, wait a second, I can create a cryptocurrency and basically sell it to somebody, and I can create money out of thin air in 15 minutes. You can create a crypto, anybody who's like a decent programmer can create a cryptocurrency in 15 minutes.
Wow.
And so all of these other cryptocurrencies were created after once people woke up to the fact that, wait a second, we can create cryptocurrencies that aren't bound by the same limitations that Bitcoin is, and we can monetize them, sell them into the market, and basically become literally millionaires and eventually literally billionaires. In the span of blink of an eye. And so all that's the kind of the difference is Bitcoin actually takes in order to create it, you have to take in real world energy, real world computing power,
because it has
real
to be world mined.
Time. Exactly. Yeah. It actually has to be mined. Whereas these other cryptocurrencies, they did almost all of them do what's called a pre-mine, where you have a small group of very powerful people decide, okay, what's going to be the total supply of this currency? Who are we going to distribute this currency to? Because they pre-mine a bunch of the coins. They distribute them among the founders of the project and probably, some larger either governmental entities or celebrities or whatever. And those entities help them pump the coin. They do marketing for the coin.
Yes. Yes.
And so that gets the name out there.
Yeah.
People start to buy it. They go, exactly. It's a pump and dump.
Yep.
And so a lot of these things, the rationale for a lot of these currencies and even more insidiously, the people who buy them is exactly the kind of the thinking that you espoused earlier, which is, hey, I'm too late to Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. I'm too late to actually make money in Bitcoin. So I'm going to buy these smaller things and hope that they go up rapidly, over time.
Hit. That's right.
Hope they hit. Now, again, right. that in of itself, the hoping they hit is not like that's not it's not the end of the world. You know, it's not like the worst thing ever. Or at least it doesn't have to be. But for a lot of people, like that just becomes, I mean, that it just becomes gambling.
Mm.
Now, what's the difference between gambling? Again, this is where we can have conversations about this.
Yeah.
But really,
you just got to know how to pick the right pony, man.
Exactly. But now we're not talking about money. We're talking about these are lottery tickets.
Mm-hmm.
And so whatever you think about Bitcoin, you have to know that like authorial intent matters. We're Christians. We believe authorial intent matters. Bitcoin was created not with that mindset in mind. It wasn't designed to be, hey, let's create this lottery ticket that maybe we can all get rich. It was designed to be a parallel system, a parallel monetary system that would allow people to opt out of a system that would, you know, that would basically allowed their currency units to be devalued.
Well, and from what I can see too, in the Bitcoin landscape, I mean, I've done a little homework here.
Okay.
The mining isn't over yet. Right.
Yep.
There's still Bitcoin being mined out even now, and probably will be for the next like 5 to 10 years. Right.
So it's actually still going to be until the last Bitcoin will be mined in the year 2040. So we still have 100. Yeah. Still have 100 in, you know, 15 years. The issue though is, and again, this is why for a lot of people, when they first hear about Bitcoin, they hear about Bitcoin mining and they're saying, wait, you're telling me I can mine my own money. I can get a computer. I can turn it on, set it to work, and I can actually make money. Wow, that's great. The issue is, it actually is great. But the problem is, though, that in order to mine Bitcoin mining is one of the most competitive markets in the entire world.
And you need a mega computer to do it.
Correct. Well, so that's the thing, is you have to buy very powerful computers. Okay. And these computers are, this is a longer topic, but I refer to them, there's a very real sense in which they're like, there's similarities between Bitcoin mining computers and like the priesthood. Okay. Because these, I know it's the weirdest, sounds like the weirdest thing. It's actually way less weird, but we don't have time to get into it. But the reason I say that is because in the same way that that priests are set apart, they're holy to the Lord. They're given to the Lord's work. They only focus on what he's doing.
I know exactly where you're going.
Bitcoin mining computers. You can't just like surf the web on Bitcoin mining computers. They're literally made to do one thing, which is mine Bitcoin.
Well, I've seen these machines. Yeah. Like it's basically a box of fans, you know,
correct.
All point at the processor and just try to keep the thing cool. Because it's an incredible algorithm and equation that you have to run to be able to pull this stuff off. Like it's, and I think, I probably priced a few machines about 2 years ago and they started around 10 grand a piece. Like that was the entry piece. It was
so ironically, that was one of the, so what happens again, because again, this is the freest market on earth. Okay. It's the freest market on earth. That's why Bitcoin is so volatile, is because it's a free market. There's no government who's overseeing Bitcoin and making sure that, you know, setting the price and setting price caps for either the miners themselves or the Bitcoin. The volatility is the price. It's the price of being alive. I say this all the time that Bitcoin, again, people object to the volatility of Bitcoin, but Bitcoin is volatile for the same reason that my 3-year-old son is volatile, because he's very young. He's growing like crazy. Okay. He's going through the greatest period of growth he'll ever experience. And again, he's growing like crazy. So like this is just something we experience this type of volatility all the time in other parts of our life, but we just get so used to that volatility that we just don't even think about it anymore.
Yeah.
This is another example I give is imagine an alien came down from space. Okay. And the alien starts to inquire about our lives. Right. And he asks, well, where does your food come from? You know, where do those vegetables come from? And the farmer starts to explain to him, well, you know, we plant these seeds in the ground. And then it starts to produce the fruit and the vegetables. And he goes, wow, you literally just bury them and you do some work and you bury them in the ground. And then they just, you know, he's like, how do they come about? And he's like, oh, we just leave them. You know, we leave them and we make sure they get water, make sure they get sun, but then they just grow on their own. And the alien is just stunned. He's like, what? This is like magic. This is incredible. And he's like, so then what happens? And he's like, you know, the farmer says, well, no, then everything grows. And then we harvest the stuff and then all the plants die. And he goes, what do you mean all the plants died? And the farmer goes, yeah, you know, like, well, you know, for a couple months, 2 or 3 months a year, everything dies. And then it just comes back to life. And the alien goes, well, how do you know it's going to come back? And the farmer goes, well, you know, we don't have any, like, there's no, like, contract or, like, guarantee it's going to come back. But just that's what it does. Just due to the nature of things, that's just how it works. And the guy, you can imagine the alien going, well, that just seems so volatile. How do you know? How do you, you know, like, what's the proof that you have that this is going to happen?
Yeah.
And the reality is we don't have that proof. The proof is that God loves us and God's made the world to function certain ways. Mm. And so this, you know, this risk and this volatility is part of the way that God has designed the natural world to function. And part of our desire to escape volatility is in part a desire to escape and not live in the world that God has made and not have to trust him the way that God calls us and loves us so much that he wants us to trust him.
Yeah, and so I've heard it said by some that if you want a risk-free life, what you actually want is slavery. It's
correct.
That's the way that it plays out. If there is risk, if you're going to be free, there is risk involved. You have to create, you have to work hard, and it might work and it might not work, but that's the price of being a free person. I think that's a great point.
And another way to say it is if you want to avoid risk is to want to be God.
and so that's
constantly our temptation, right? Is to want to be God. And this is the temptation from as early as we've been tempted. This is literally what Adam, you know, what the serpent tempted Adam and Eve with is, you know, you can be like God. And humans have always been tempted by that desire to not have anybody who can tell them no and to not have to deal with uncertainty. We want certainty. We would rather deal with, we'd rather be able to take things into our hands and provide for our own selves rather than trust God and rely on him. And so, yeah, so that would be, that's part of the difference is Bitcoin is volatile. It's doesn't have, you know, nobody controls it. And so it is volatile on a day-to-day basis, but that volatility, it's also primarily volatile to the upside. I'm doing another interview right after this. And the guy sent me some questions in advance. And he basically said, like, how is Bitcoin performed relative to other things? And the answer to that is that Bitcoin's CAGR, which is its compound annual growth rate, is about 104% every year. So again, everyone thinks about the volatility. Everybody thinks about the volatility and they think about the downside volatility.
Right.
But Bitcoin is for its 15 years it's existed has been far more volatile to the upside over time. It's like this thing that it's like if we're following the video here, it goes up and down and it continues to go up, but it's primarily going up.
Yes.
Because you have more and more people who are buying, more people who are, you know, understanding it and trying to deal with this the fact that we live in a world where the currency in every country on earth becomes more and more worthless relative to the scarce goods that we, you know, that we need to live.
Yes. Absolutely. Okay, so we're running out of time, but let me ask one more question, and you could just kick me in the right direction.
Okay.
My curiosity is piqued. I'm ready to learn more and buy in. How do I do both?
Yeah, so I mean, you can learn more about, again, to get like a longer version of some of the things that we talked about here. We're doing a conference in Nashville in July, July 24th and 25th. It's at Rocket Town for those diehard Michael W. Smith fans out there. That's Michael W. Smith. This is a little venue that he founded. There's going to be a bunch of people there, including probably a bunch of people your audience will recognize. So Michael Foster will be there, C.R. Wiley, Glenn Sunshine. Who's the other one? Bunch of folks. Oh, Ben Merkel, Dr. Ben Merkel will be there.
Man,
bunch of other guys as well. We're going to be going through, again, looking at economics through Christian lens. And then the second day is going to look into Bitcoin through Christian lens. So that's one place. I also host a podcast called the Thank God for Bitcoin podcast. I largely, at this point, I'm interviewing Christians who work in the Bitcoin world or who are into Bitcoin. There's another podcast called, I think it's Bitcoin in the Bible, where they go much more into much more granular detail about how Bitcoin works, what it is. That'd be another place to go. Awesome. In terms of how to actually buy some, what I would recommend is probably a lot of your audience, people who are familiar with Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies at all, know the name Coinbase.
Yep.
Okay. Coinbase is the biggest company in the space. They're just really well known. The problem with Coinbase goes back to the problem with the incentives around these other cryptocurrencies. So Coinbase sells, I think, like 10,000 different cryptocurrencies.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, why do they sell 10,000 cryptocurrencies? Do they actually believe, again, just like any other store has products that they sell, and you don't want to sell garbage products because then it gives you a bad name.
Sure.
So the question is, if Jordan, you're saying that all these are almost all these other cryptocurrencies are garbage, why on earth would Coinbase sell them? Well, the answer is very simple. Because Coinbase makes 1.5 to 2% off of every single time anyone buys or sells any of those cryptocurrencies.
Hmm.
And so if you look around and you, long story short, if you find an exchange that sells all these cryptocurrencies, know that the incentive alignment is such that they're basically tempted to put their own short-term financial gain above the interest of the long-term interest of their customers. Mm. So that can be, you can contrast that, companies that sell all these cryptocurrencies with there's a handful of companies that only sell Bitcoin.
Hmm.
Now, even if you don't think that Bitcoin is the only thing that's going to be, it's going to win in the end, or you don't believe any of the spiel we just talked about, the one thing that you can know for sure from a company that sells only Bitcoin is that they are leaving millions of dollars on the table in the short term to not sell all those things and not make that 1.5 to 2% off of those things. So you can think that they're idiots, but you can't think that they're corrupt. You can't think that they're only motivated by making money, because it doesn't make monetary sense to do what they're doing in the short term.
Mm.
So for that, there's a company called River. There's a company called Swan that only sell Bitcoin. I can give you we have a referral code. You don't have to use that at all, but that just basically helps our relationship as a company, Think Over Bitcoin, people to know, or helps them to know that people can't found them through us and that we're valuable people to partner with.
Well, send it to me. After we're done with the recording. Then whenever I post the interview, I'll post that code along with it, and we'll see if we can't get some folks in there. So, well, man, we're out of time. I know you got an interview right out of this. Thank you so much, Jordan, for coming and talking to me about this. I found it super helpful. Hopefully people watching found it helpful as well. Where can they go? What's the web address for your conference?
Yep. You go to tgfb.com and you can go tgfb.com/conference has all the details. We're going to be updating that, I think, tomorrow or the next day with more details around the conference. So yeah, that'd be the place to go.
Awesome. Well, Jordan, thank you so much for hanging out with us. Guys, thanks for watching another episode or listening to another episode of the TacticsCon podcast. Appreciate you. Go to tacticscon.com for more information and more details on this year's upcoming conference. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks, Stuart.